Welcome to Coffee First, the podcast about leaders and leadership. In each episode, we invite you to listen to a unique conversation about an individual's journey to understand what leadership is and how they've built their businesses around those learnings. We ask each guest to share those experiences and provide us with some reflections to put into practice ourselves. I'm your host, Adam Saunders, managing partner in the UK office and global board member of AMROP, the executive search partnership shaping sustainable success through inspiring leaders. Today's guest is Mark Laudel, a professor of cell and tissue therapy at UCL. He is a clinical scientist specializing in translational immunotherapy and regenerative medicine, work which is focused on the development of cell and tissue medicines for immunotherapy and transplantation. Mark is a co-founder and owner of two businesses, Inmune Bio, a business which Mark co-founded in 2015 and which has reached the landmark go-ahead to undertake human trials for cancer treatments. He is also a co-founder of Autolimus, a tech company which provides software solutions for the manufacture of cell and gene therapy. What is important about this episode is that it showcases leadership against the backdrop of an emerging scientific and commercial market, where the push and pull of both sides of that union create truly unique challenges for leaders who are trailblazing in this cutting-edge landscape. So, it's with great pleasure that I welcome Mark onto the show to chat with us about his world and his journey. Hello, Mark.
Hello, Adam. Good to catch up.
It really is. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know you're busy anyway, but in particular, at the moment, you're very, very busy.
Yeah, it's pretty chaotic at the moment with clinical trials reopening after the COVID crisis.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I know we're going to touch on. And in actual fact, as I read that introduction that we wrote, it has highlighted the fact that due to the nature of what you do, the technical nature of what you do, I'm going to be continually coming back to you and asking you to really dumb down your explanations for the layperson, which I certainly represent. And to that end, it might be interesting, before we start, perhaps for you to frame your current role, firstly in the academic field, and then secondly on the commercial side with your two businesses.
Yeah, so if we use the term academic loosely, so I work one day a week for UCL, 3 days a week for the Royal Free London NHS Foundation Trust. And so my activities are actually mostly within the hospital, although they support clinical trials across the whole of the Academic Health Centre, which is UCL Partners. And we have trials all over the country and some abroad. My main role is actually physically in the Royal Free Hospital as a clinical scientist, as you say. So there is a mechanism within the NHS to take people with quasi-clinical experience, so not medically qualified. I'm not medically qualified. And you have specific roles, so some radiologists. I'm an immunopathologist, so I'm a diagnostic immunologist from training. If you came in for a particular type of a pathology test, if you say you had rheumatoid arthritis or something, that's the sort of thing that I train to be able to look at, interpret, and say to you, yes, you fall into this category, you should see a rheumatologist to get the following treatment. So that's where I sit within the trust, but the trust employs me as the director of cell and tissue therapy. So I have a team of 21 NHS staff and another 20 university staff. And we run what is now probably the most active, so largest in terms of activity, but sadly not largest in terms of square meterage, but the largest in terms of activity manufacturing space to make these novel or not so much novel now, but increasingly important cell and gene therapies. And many of people listening to this will have heard of the big landmark front page of Time magazine in 2010, what was called the CAR T cell, chimeric antigen receptor T cells. And that was the first real cell therapy to take headlines. The technology was bought out of a university in America by Novartis and commercialized, and it's now a commercially available cell drug that's manufactured from a patient's own cells to treat that specific patient. And that's really the sort of field that I sit in. We manufacture cells into medicines and tissues into medicines, sometimes with genetic modification, therefore being a gene therapy, sometimes without. And we do that in a very specialized facility at the Royal Free Hospital, which is, as I say, very active.
Okay, fantastic. And from a commercial perspective, Mark?
Yeah, so as I think we'll probably discuss over the call, this field has burgeoned. I mean, when I started this, there was no concept of commercialization. It's become very commercial, particularly with Novartis stepping in. Pfizer got in a little bit earlier than Novartis. Gilead have come in since. So some of the big pharma companies are taking this very seriously. And so in order to develop these therapies to get them out to the right number of patients that actually need them, you've got to commercialize them. And that's really where we came from. And so I ostensibly do one day a week working for my company, Immune Bio, which is a US-based company on NASDAQ. But all of the research on my part of it stays within London, and we contract that research from the university and manufacturing from the hospital. So we pay back our bit. And so that occupies a lot of my time. So it's mostly weekends, evenings, and all day Monday to develop that company. And other companies that I'm involved in, you mentioned Autolus, are really there to solve problems for the field, problems that I've identified because we are, you know, at the forefront of manufacturing. So you see what's needed and you go out and say, well, there isn't a solution for this. The only way to get that solution is to take it on and do it yourself. So, it comes out of that sort of entrepreneurial thing that most people in my space do. We've had to make do. We've had to invent to get these therapies to patients.
So normally when we do these conversations, we kick off with the question, what does leadership mean to you? But actually, I feel it's quite important that we frame immunology a little bit more clearly for people who perhaps don't know. And I would certainly put my hand up and say that I didn't really understand the breadth of it and how important it is. So perhaps you could start by just explaining what problems immunology is trying to solve.
Okay, so immunology is probably the youngest of the pathology or scientific disciplines in medicine. So, you know, the immune response is what keeps us all alive. At the very most primitive level, it's how a sponge, because if you think about a sponge that you've got in the bath, that's obviously a dead sponge, but a live sponge, it might be this big, but it's actually thousands of individual little animals. It's not one animal. And all of those animals have to get on, and they have to know, in inverted commas, that the animal next to them is part of their little team and it isn't from another sponge. And so what's really fascinating about sponges, and I won't bore you forever, but they are a perfect example of how important the immune system is. If you take a sponge and you push it through a sieve and make it into lots and lots and lots of individual little sponges, and you put them into a jar, they will grow back as a sponge again. But if you take two unrelated sponges, do that and mix them together, they will form two unrelated sponges. They don't join together. So the sponges know that I'm sponge A and I'm sponge B and the two must never combine. And what happens is at the points where they touch, the cells, they're all different. They're all the same cell. They're all multiple organisms. But the organism that's sitting at the edge of the sponge develops in such a way that it takes on a role that the other sponge cells don't have. And that is to kill sponge cells that come from a sponge next door. So if it starts to be invaded by another sponge, it's taking up its space. The sponge cells on this side kill the sponge cells that are trying to, and it's a permanent battle. And the molecules that they use are the same molecules that our immune system uses to protect us from cancer and viral infections. And I think that is fundamentally exciting.
I think probably for the whole of this discussion, it's going to be important for us to separate the two aspects of your life, the academic and the commercial. And it's fair to say that we haven't mentioned all of the businesses that you're involved in, because I know that you're a consultant and have involvement in a number of others.
Yeah. So I'm a co-founder of Achilles, which is a T-cell immunotherapy company. Just treated our first two patients in our first two trials, so that's very exciting. And you know, I'm a consultant to lots of others, some big pharma, some little. Yeah.
Okay. And can you perhaps just give us a really quick headline summary of what Immune Bio is trying to achieve and what Autolus is trying to achieve?
Okay. So Immune Bio is a company that I co-founded with two colleagues. We went public in 2019 on NASDAQ, and we're doing trials in everything we do is innate immunotherapy. So it's in the inflammatory system in the innate response, the natural killer cell killer system in the innate response, and we're targeting cancer, we're targeting neurological diseases. You know, we've got a very broad spectrum, but the focus is purely on the innate immune system.
And Autolus?
Yeah, so in 2008, 2009, it became apparent to me that we just couldn't make these patient-specific, what we call autologous, cell therapies at the scale that was needed, simply because the paperwork in manufacturing a drug is just too great. So we needed to digitize it. But the problem we had was that if you digitized it, you couldn't digitize it securely. So to manufacture a drug, you have to know who did what when and who approved what when, and data trace that and data lock it. So we couldn't develop the software. And then in 2016, a man knocked on my door, and he was an expert in blockchain and had a blockchain company. And he said, can you see a field where we could apply blockchain in your area? And I said, absolutely, we could use blockchain to secure an electronic batch manufacturing record in cell therapies. So he said he could do it. I didn't believe him because I'm a skeptical scientist. I gave him a very, very difficult batch manufacturing record and said, if you can go away and digitize that, I'll believe you. And 6 weeks later, the software guys came back and said, there's your digitized BMR. And I went, okay, we'll form a company. So February last year, we formed a company called Autonomous, and we've just raised our second round of funding and just about to announce our first US contract.
Okay, and this is where I think it gets really interesting, because what we have are effectively leadership for you is falling into a few different camps, isn't it? It's falling squarely in the academic space and the commercial space, and then there is this entrepreneurial piece, which is you're creating the market as you go along and using technology to help you solve the problem that's really the kind of the driver that sits behind you. So to that extent then, let's get back to that first initial question, because I think now we can talk about leadership. We've set the tone. What does leadership mean to you?
So I think I would sum it up as leadership is the ability to delegate authority whilst retaining responsibility. So you've got to be able to lead your team and allow them to develop with the security that if they make a mistake, it's your mistake. So the most important part of leadership that I see is not so much the delivery, but empowering the team to deliver on your behalf.
Yeah. Like so many of us, it's only really with hindsight that you realize how influential certain people have been in your life. Your father was one of those people, wasn't he?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah. My father had a business with a lot of staff. And during the 1970s, as you will probably remember, the industrial strife was rampant. You know, everybody was having strikes. And I was in a car with my father going up to an exhibition at the Birmingham International. And the radio was all about miners' strikes and whatever. And I said to him, Dad, you know, why don't your guys strike? Why have you never had a problem? And he said, because I go down onto the shop floor at least once a week, quite often more than that, have coffee with them, have tea with them, chat to them, and empower them and ask them, what do you think we're doing well? What could we do better? And interestingly, it was 40 years later, I met David Sloman, who is the chief executive of the Royal Free and is now chief executive of NHS London. And I knew David because he really supported our work hugely. We are where we are largely because of David. And he was sitting in a chair in a corridor at the Royal Free Hospital. And I said, David, have you been kicked out of your office? And he said, no, whenever I have a meeting planned that gets cancelled at a late minute, I just find a chair somewhere in a corridor in the hospital and sit down. And people come along and sit down and say, David, this doesn't work. Or David, I didn't get that. I said, I learn more about what's going wrong in the hospital by sitting on a chair in a corridor than ever going into a board meeting. And I thought that's exactly the sort of approach my father had. Go and ask the people who are at the sharp end what's going wrong. It's very interesting that, you know, 40 years apart, two people who I have huge respect for had exactly the same approach to management. Yeah.
And I know, like a lot of people, sport has played a part. You know, I think you had a rugby coach that was particularly impactful on you. But there was also a moment in the cadets that you've talked to me about, which I think is really interesting, the warrant officer. Tell us a bit about that one.
Yeah, so when I was at university, I was in the University Air Squadron, and we had the fortune of going to Cranwell. And that's where this whole concept, it was one of the warrant officers talking to us about when you become a junior officer, suddenly, you know, you have to be listened to. And yet people that you are commanding may well be, or mostly are, older than you and have 10, 20, 30 years more experience than you. And yet you're the person that's effectively telling them what to do. And how do you manage that? How do you use their advice and let them feel empowered or recognize really that they are empowered because they know and you don't, and yet maintain that position. And so it's about not being proud of being the manager. It's about being humble whilst being the manager. And he was the man that said to very early, you can delegate your authority, but you can't delegate your responsibility. And that's what management is as an officer. Effectively, if you say to somebody, go on and get this done, and they don't do it or they do it badly, it's your fault at the bottom end. And I think that really was the take-home message that changed the way I do things. Yeah.
I love that. It's great. And it's this same theme, isn't it, that leadership and rank are totally different things. One doesn't necessarily follow the other. And we hear that from so many people.
Yeah, the biggest problems I see with junior staff working for me, not so much now, but I've seen it, is people who get to a position in management and think that that gives them an immediate right to respect. And whenever this happens, I say, you earn respect, you earn that right. It doesn't come with the title that you've got. And so you've really got to not just earn that respect at the beginning, you've got to continue earning that respect. It's very easy to lose your team if they no longer respect you because you don't have integrity or you don't support them or you're seen not backing them up. I think that's the biggest issue.
So your relationship with immunology really came about by chance, if I understand correctly. You had a very clear idea of where you were going and what you were doing at university, but a chance encounter, and I think actually quite a fantastic bit of play by someone who clearly saw something in you, propositioned you in a particular way, didn't they? Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I was, as I said earlier on, fascinated in evolution. I think I read Richard Dawkins' Selfish Gene as a young teenager, and it just blew my head. And so, you know, I knew doing A-level biology that parasites are perfectly evolved for the niche in which they live. And so I figured parasitology was the best way of investigating evolution. And I chose a university college in London University where there was a big parasitology interest and was lucky enough to get a place there. When I turned up, that unit had moved on, and so I went and saw the professor and said, look, very sorry, but you know, I came here because it was a parasitology center and it just isn't any longer, and you know, I'd like to change college. And he said, why are you so interested in parasitology? And I said, because it's the proof of evolution. And he said, oh no, wait. And he said, immunology is the proof of evolution, it's much, much more dynamic. So I didn't even know what immunology was, and he was an invertebrate immunologist, which was really fundamental because that allowed me to understand that the immune system isn't just something you see in a mouse, which most immunology is done in mice, I'm afraid. It's something that actually goes back a lot earlier than that. And so he took me under his wing and he said, you know, you can do the immunology course. And then he allowed me, or I applied and he approved it. I spent most of my final year doing the clinical immunology program at Middlesex Hospital Medical School. And I was, once again, extremely lucky. I dropped into immunology just as HIV became, or AIDS as it were, became a big thing. Suddenly money became available, people were beginning to be interested in immunology. I think Jim Allison wouldn't have got the Nobel Prize for immunotherapy 2 years ago if it hadn't been for HIV back in the 1980s, because that drove all of the reagents we use. When I started out, if you wanted to test to see if someone had an autoimmune response to causing their diabetes, most of those reagents we actually made in the lab. We went and injected mice with things. We raised antibodies. We made our own reagents. Now you just ring up and they come off a shelf somewhere. So the HIV thing was great for me, but it was far, far more important globally because it allowed this explosion in technology, in equipment, and made immunology really a mainstream science and led to the immunotherapy that got Jim Allison, very, very rightly, the Nobel Prize.
Have you ever thought about what would what you'd be doing right now if that chance encounter hadn't happened and you'd gone down the zoology route?
Do you know, I think about that an awful lot. I can't imagine what would have happened. I don't know what I'd be doing. I might be with a Land Rover with a Labrador in the back going and measuring bird colonies on the Isle of Skye. I don't know. But
That doesn't sound so bad.
No.
But I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. Okay, so you end up then working with Ivan Reut, who turns out literally to be the guy that wrote the book on your area of expertise. How much of an impact did that relationship have on you?
Well, I didn't realise it at the time. You know, he gave me advice about being an immunologist. I've met him since, and he can't even remember that. I was one of thousands of students that he would have said that to, and I was just very lucky. Funnily enough, a story I tell Ivan, you know, the reason why I'm married to my wife is because of Ivan Reut. Immunology is very badly, or at least in the 1980s, was very badly taught to medical students, and most of them just hated it. And I speak as someone who taught them. And when I first met my wife, it was a collaborative research project when she was a junior doctor in training. And I went round to her house to sort out a publication we were writing together, and noticed in her study that she had one of Ivan Reut's textbooks, and the spine wasn't even cracked. And I jokingly said to her at the time, you know, you can't even read an immunology textbook. You plainly need an immunologist. And subsequently, obviously, she got one. And I tell Ivan that if his book had been more readable, my wife would have read it, and I'd never have married her. So, you know.
So your first real taste of leadership came very early when you were 27, but not long after that, at 32, you become associate professor and senior lecturer. How was that? How did you find that experience?
So I was very lucky in that, you know, as you say, at 27, I had to step up and take over ownership of a technical department. And the NHS is very good even now. It has leadership training. And so I was able to tap into leadership training. And one of the great courses was called Getting Things Done. And it was about change management. And I think change management is something that leadership regularly gets wrong. And so it was great at a very early age to be taught about change management. And I turn up as a man who's got no history whatsoever in hematology as a new, very, very young senior lecturer. I was by far the youngest in the department. And yeah, that's, you've got to try and get people that are there to believe in you and believe that you're bringing something. You're coming from outside their field. So although they're working for you, I had a clinical lecturer working for me who knew far more about, probably still does actually, far more about hematology than I ever did. And I had to persuade him that when I said, this is the experimental plan we're going to do, this is what we're going to look at, that he should risk his research time in joining me in that. So yeah, a lot of challenge when we first got there. And they were very, very stressful years, the first few years.
Okay, Mark, when do things really start to take off for immunology, commercially speaking?
So we knew in the late 80s, early 90s, that patients who are treated for leukemia with a bone marrow transplant, it's actually the bone marrow transplant that cures them. They're getting the immune response of the donor, and it's the immune response in that transplant that cures them. So hematologists have believed in immunotherapy of cancer since the 1990s. Solid tumour oncologists have been much more difficult to persuade that. And it really wasn't until the mid-2000s when this concept that won Jim Allison the Nobel Prize, he first published in the late 90s that there are molecules that the cancer cell uses to switch off the immune response to the cancer cell. They're called checkpoints. And he made antibodies to those checkpoints and blocked the checkpoints and showed that in mice, the mouse now would make an immune response to that cancer and get rid of it. And this led to a whole pharmaceutical explosion of antibodies that block these checkpoints called checkpoint inhibitors, CPIs. And so that really, really was the sort of sea change in getting clinicians to understand that the immune response was important and was valuable. So yeah, I think that the mid-2000s and thereafter really was the explosion of immunology as a cancer therapy.
The commercial side of that has been slower on the uptake, hasn't it? Why has that been?
So two things. Pharmaceutical companies are not so dynamic, and this is a field that has not really been a pharmaceutical field. So their R&D units haven't been working on immunotherapy pretty much. And drug companies historically develop drugs internally. You know, take one compound, they randomly change it and see what it does. That's not really the way that you work in the field of immunology. And what we've seen, certainly in what we call advanced therapies, these cellular and gene therapies, they're even now 80 to 90% of new cell and gene therapies that are being discovered are coming out of academic units and being bought by big pharma or small pharma or creating spin-outs. It's not being developed by the pharmaceutical company themselves. So that is something that took a lot of change. It's still actually quite slow. But this story of the checkpoint inhibitors, these reagents that bind to molecules that the tumor cell uses to evade the immune system, those are much more like the sort of conventional drugs. Okay, they're made in big bioreactors, thousands of liters. And those sort of drugs were already being made by big pharma companies. So drug companies got into the checkpoint inhibitor story in immunotherapy, the idea of using antibodies as reagents that are made in a huge batch, like any other drug, and shipped like any other drug to a pharmacy, like any other drug, and prescribed from the pharmacy and taken to the patient and injected in the patient like any other drug. They could commercialize that. And so that's really the explosion in immunotherapy with checkpoint inhibitors started in the 2000s, and it fitted into a model that already existed in big pharma. With cell and gene therapy, that model did not exist in big pharma and has been a real challenge. And I think if you went and spoke to my counterpart in Novartis or GlaxoSmithKline, they would say, yeah, it's been a real challenge to take these things on board. And even to this date, for my little tiny facility at the Royal Free Hospital is currently manufacturing a drug for a big pharmaceutical company. They own that drug. It's a cell and gene therapy drug. They have all the resources that a big pharma company has, but they realize that they actually don't have the skills to make it. So they're paying us to make it for them. Great for the trust. They're making a lot of money out of it. And it's great for us because the kudos is there. And it's great for the patient because they'll get a drug much more quickly because we know how to make it. But big pharma find these things very, very difficult. They don't have the skill sets in-house. It's a completely different. They're chemists and pharmacists. We're cell biologists and people who do A-level chemistry and A-level physics don't necessarily do A-level biology. And there's a big difference.
Okay, so let's talk now about your current businesses, the two that we've been speaking about, and particularly the leadership challenges inherent in them. I'd like to start off with asking you firstly, what made you take that step, out of academia into the commercial world? What was the trigger point, the pivotal moment, if there was one?
So it's interesting, and it sounds twee, but this is absolutely true. It was ethics. So if you think about a cell therapy, nearly every cell therapy we make it as a patient specific. So we take cells out of the blood of that patient. We manipulate them in some way, depending on what the therapy is, in an ultra, ultra, ultra clean laboratory. We test the product to make certain it does what it says on the tin. We then put it in a fancy tin and we label it appropriately. And then I am lucky enough to have a bit of paper that says I can take legal responsibility for it. I sign to say this is legally a drug and it can be given to a patient, and we ship it back to the patient. Okay. Now, that is something which there isn't a good animal model for that in any of the drugs that we make. So if you go and have aspirin at some, not that aspirin's a bad example, but if you go and have a checkpoint inhibitor, any of the conventional drugs that you can think of, chemotherapy, whatever, that has been put into an animal and they know the maximum dose before you start to get side effects. We can't do that with nearly every therapy we make. So the term guinea pig is overused, but in cell and gene therapies, it really is a guinea pig. The first patient you treat is a real guinea pig. And it's a huge responsibility to say to a patient, I've got this medicine that we've invented. Well, certainly when we did the first NK trial with my own IP, I sat down with the patient number one, Joanne, and said, I really want you to understand that we don't know whether this is going to do you any good, but we also don't know whether it's going to do you any harm. It's very easy when you're sitting in where we are and saying, well, actually, this patient's got fatal leukemia. Of course, they'll have something experimental. Why wouldn't they? Well, actually, they need to understand that if you've got fatal leukemia and you've been told that you've got a life expectancy of 6 weeks, and I'm giving you a drug that could kill you in 6 hours, that 6 weeks suddenly is very, very, very precious, far more precious than if you said, well, you could do whatever and I'm going to reduce your life expectancy by 6 weeks. So that is very, very powerful. And when I saw Joanne and said this to her, I've invented this, I feel very passionate about it, but you have to understand that this could kill you. And she said, yes, but actually you'd learn something for another patient. And that's really, I don't expect this to cure me, but you're going to learn something that will help another patient. And I took that away and mulled over. And what I realized then was that that's probably true in 90% of the patients that we treat. And what they really mean is not just it's going to be good for one other patient. They mean it's going to have a fundamental impact potentially on other patients with leukemia or other patients with breast cancer or whatever. So if we're going to do these studies that are high risk in these patients who are brave enough and generous enough with their time and their life to let us test these things, we have to be able to have the capacity to treat every patient that needs it if it works. We can't just say, I've treated 10 patients. Wow, it's great. Someone else is going to have to do this to turn this into a drug. And it's not the role of hospitals to make billions of doses of drug. So you've got to be able to commercialize it. So that's really was, it was sitting down with Joanna and we were interviewed on the television. We did a morning show and we did Radio 4 and whatever together when she was treated with Women's Hour on Radio 4 with Jenny Murray. I remember it well. And she made me think that actually there's an ethical dimension to this. And as academics, we shouldn't just treat 10 patients and write a paper to get in Nature Medicine. We should be looking at the bigger picture. And the only way you can do that is to set up a company and commercialize it or sell it to a company that's going to commercialize it for you. And both work. It's just no one's been brave enough to buy anything that I've invented. So I've had to set up the companies.
So that's very much a theme that we see actually in your space and in your career. Before we jump into that, from your experience in both academia and the commercial space, is leadership the same experience for you?
No, I think I've had to learn a lot of skills that I didn't have, but they're not necessarily leadership skills. They have been different managerial skills sets. You know, obviously finances are completely different in the two scenarios where you get them from. But no, I don't think leadership per se has been different. Whether the team working for me is paid for by Immune Bio or whether they're paid for by a research grant doesn't really focus. And I think the sort of people that we get into companies, they're not substantially different from the people we get into our academic groups, because this is such a specialized field. People are being sucked out of academia, if you like, to come into these companies. And nearly every company that I've been involved in has been staffed by people we've taken from my lab or other labs. So their mindset is the same. So it's not a leadership challenge, because you know the mindset set is the same.
You've mentioned already that Big Pharma has been pretty slow to pick this up. And so the industry is very much built around smaller, agile, nimble businesses. Would you say that your businesses are entrepreneurial in nature?
Oh, definitely. So there is a sort of business model for spin-out companies in this field, which is file your IP with the university or yourself or whatever, and go out and find a venture capitalist to throw a lot of money into your company, get your Series A funding of several million, start the company, start to employ staff, find some space, start to run it just like you do your own research lab, but with money coming from a different route. With Immune Bio, we said that wasn't going to happen from get-go. So we went out and David Moss, our CFO, managed to use an awful lot of contacts to raise millions of dollars, actually, from small investors. And so we ran it like that. And we own a big chunk of the company still, the founders. And then took it straight, without any VC, took it straight to filing on the NASDAQ. So the only way you can do that with a small amount of money to do an awful lot of work, we pay. So, for example, all of our R&D around my therapy is actually done in university space that we rent. So we pay the university to do a research project for us. Now, I run that. It's done in my lab by staff who are employed on that. The university takes, you know, they're 100% overhead, so they're very happy. But we don't have to pay a huge amount of money for a whole research team. So we've been very, very nimble and very dynamic. And really, the company's sort of six people running that many trials. It's remarkable. And we're able to contract manufacture of the drug because I own the drug, so I manufacture it at the Royal Free, and we pay the Royal Free for that manufacturing space. So yeah, it's a completely different route, and it's been very exciting looking at a different way of running a company.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. What you're describing would, in any other industry, be, I think, a disruptor, right? You're making it up as you go along. You're not following the well-trodden path, and you're solving problems as they come to you on an iterative basis, which I think is is hugely interesting. I have a question for you. Do you consider yourself an entrepreneur?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. A person who organizes and manages any enterprise, especially one that's considered, has a considerable sort of initiative or risk basis is the definition. And I think that qualifies wholeheartedly. Tell me a little bit about the hoteling, the process of hoteling that you really have created and how that works between the two entities again, because it's another great example.
Yeah, I'm quite proud of that. So back in 2007, a guy called Greg Sando came to see me, who was an ex-banker from Deutsche Bank. We formed a company called Cell Medica, and when it came to manufacturing that drug, I suggested that what we did was the company should rent time in my hospital facility, which was much smaller than it is now, but we were making medicines back then in my labs. We should rent space there when we were not using it. So instead of Cell Medica having to go out and raise money to build their own manufacturing suite and try to set up from scratch, which would have cost millions, we said, well, look, we have downtime when we're not manufacturing our cell therapies, so why don't we sell that to you? And you can operate then under our manufacturing license, under our quality system. The drugs will legally be signed off by the Royal Free Hospital, but you will do the clinical trials. And it worked extremely well. And now the Royal Free we use that hotel system for a number of different companies. Achilles are in there, Immune Bio's in there, companies which I'm not involved in are also in there. Plus, and we use that to subsidize the academic trials that we do, and the trust makes a profit out of it. So it's been very, very successful, and now it's being promulgated elsewhere. So the hotel story has gone all the way around, which is really, really nice. You know, we conceived it, and now it's sort of an international model.
And I've been counting as we've gone along in our discussions, and I'm running out of fingers of how many businesses that you are involved in some capacity, not to mention the immense responsibility you have at the Royal Free and UCL. So how have you dealt with that from a leadership point of view, considering also you have your two babies in Immune Bio and Autonomous there? How do you stay on top of that? What leadership structure have you put in place for yourself?
I think the best example of that I can give, some years ago, I was teaching at UCL. I had an early morning lecture to give about 8:30, I think was the kickoff. And I was standing outside the lecture theatre, and it was a new course that I hadn't taught on before. So the tutor for the course was going to introduce me to the student. And so we're standing outside the lecture theatre, and my phone rang. And it was the most junior member of my team, a junior technician straight out of university. He'd only been with us for 6 weeks, and he'd come in early and gone in, and the unit had failed. The whole laboratory had shut down because of an equipment failure, critical equipment failure. And he rang me up to say, and we had two transplants that day going out, and yet the facility was shut. And he rang me up at 8:30 in the morning, and we had this conversation. I said, oh, thank you very much, Fahim. And this tutor said to me, so does that, you're going to have to leave? You're going to have to go back to the Free? And I said, no, Fahim's got it all under control. And she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, he just rang me to say that he'd been shown what you did in this environment. He picked up the big red book, which is the, oh my God, it's all gone wrong book. And he just went through it. And he knew that. And he rang me up and said, I've rung my counterpart at UCLH. We've arranged for the transplant to be moved to UCLH. So it's all going to happen at 9 o'clock this morning, just as planned, but it's all going to be done at UCLH. I've rung the engineers and they're coming in to do this. This guy had just come out of university, had 6 months in my team, but he felt empowered to be able to just follow the instructions without asking anybody else. He knew that if he did what he'd been trained to do, he couldn't be held responsible if it didn't work. And he had the leadership that my team had provided him. And I suppose, you know, you might say if you were really self-centered that you would inculcate that, but it's actually not, it's much broader than that. But the whole system of the team is that everybody all the way down trickles down to the most junior person to feel empowered to do the job that they're trained to do without worrying whether it goes well or not. And that, I think, was a perfect example of how the system works.
This is currently being recorded during COVID, and you have a large portion of your teams inside NHS facilities. And whilst they're not on the front line in that sense, they're very much in and amongst it. How has that been for them, and how has it been for you?
It has been very challenging. Obviously, the government instruction is that you should work from home if you can. And 99.9% of my work is actually, even when I'm at the Royal Free or at the UCL, is sitting behind a desk. All of my teaching commitments have gone because the students aren't there, but the rest of my time when I'm not teaching, I'm sitting behind a desk, and I can do that from home. So it hasn't really impacted me too much. As you know, we can have digital meetings with all of my staff. The challenge has been staff going in, and I don't know if you saw the BBC documentary called Hospital. That was at the Royal Free, the brilliant, brilliant documentary showing how much of a battle it really was. And my team were brilliant. I mean, they immediately identified areas where we could contribute to that. As you say, we're not frontline. Clinical trials were largely on hold, but we have an awful lot of the PPE that we use when we're manufacturing. We have to protect the product we're making, not us from the product, but the product from us. So it's the same PPE. So we were able to push PPE into the trust. The ultra sterile environment we work in, we have the capacity to completely sterilize a room in 40 minutes, including everything that's in it. And so I spent a lot, in fact, we didn't need to use it, but I spent a lot of time working on dealing with the PPE crisis, where we could reuse PPE, because as soon as you finish using it, it could be put on hangers and put into a room, and 40 minutes later, it could be completely sterile and come back and be used again. So we spent a lot of time setting that up. Unfortunately, it wasn't needed, but the team stood up to that. And so there is a degree of leadership around that. But I think the real issue has been around stopping staff from overworking. They still want to be in there doing their job. One of my staff, you know, we were in the middle of manufacturing something and commuting became really, really, really difficult. She lives in Northampton. So the commute in for her was a long train ride and then Euston Station, then the Northern Line. She developed flu-like symptoms, which were not at that stage COVID symptoms. We now know they are COVID symptoms, and she's been tested. She's antibody positive, so she was exposed. But she had flu-like symptoms, and a day later, she was back in work because she said, this product has to be made. And eventually, I had to say to her, look, no, you can't come in. You're going to have to go home. We're going to have to bin this product. So part of leadership is about stopping people, your staff, from overworking and overcommitment.
Yeah, because let's face it, you are not, you know, manufacturing comfy mattresses or some other consumer good. Your staff are creating things that they know could and hopefully will save lives. And that obviously must put a huge pressure on them. But as a leader, what you're saying, if I understand, is that you have to look after their best interests as well, the business and its success, and the opportunity for it to live and fight another day is paramount.
Yeah, my principal role is as their employer. And their line manager. And so your responsibility is to your staff. When we make a cell therapy in a clinical trial, we don't know if it's going to work. But I can at least put a risk around someone coming in to work during what was considered then to be a highly infectious episode. There are two things I'm proud of in terms of leadership. One, it's people I've developed who've gone on to really lead in their fields. And the second is the fact that the median duration of employment in my team is nearly 11 years now.
Wow, that's really good.
We develop them in-house. Some of them go away and come back, but we keep a team that's got huge corporate memory, and that's massively valuable. And it's something the trust, most hospitals really don't recognize how important it is to have people who say, we tried this 10 years and it didn't work. Let's not try it again. We make the same mistakes over and over again in the health service because we don't have any corporate memory. And I'm very lucky that we've got that. The team are brilliant.
That leads me on to the next point, actually, which I've found fascinating. This emotional connection to the subject matter and how that rubs up against the commercial need of the subject matter. Getting talent into the business side of this space can be very challenging for you because of the inherent nature of academics and the inherent nature of businesses and what they need.
Yeah. When you're trying to fund research, this research is done in university and hospital spaces, mostly university spaces. And so if you try to fund research in a university space, you've got two routes. You've either got a conventional academic grant, which is what the universities want you to get, or you've got commercial collaborations. In the medical side, the idea of getting money in from a company has always had this smell about it. That's dirty money. It's not, you didn't compete for it against millions of people and have peer review by some great, the great and the good at the MRC. you got it because the company wants something done, and it could be academically really, really poor, but they're going to throw money at it. And so for junior staff developing their career, it's really very difficult to take them out of an academic funding stream and put them into a commercial stream without potentially damaging their career prospects. And I think one of the great things we see in this field of cell and gene therapy is that so much of it is coming out of academia into these spin-out companies. So many of these spin-out companies actually are part owned by universities, that it's forcing universities to change their attitude a little bit. But it's certainly empowering junior postdocs and graduates to think, well, actually, I don't need to necessarily follow a traditional university career. I can now see a route in industry. But you're right, until the last few years, the concept of being in both camps was actually seen as very detrimental to your career.
Am I being unfair if I say that there is also a fundamental difference as well in terms of the mindset and approach of people in those two camps?
So academia is very, very aggressive, and there are very few top slots. So it's a pyramid that doesn't have much room in the middle. You're dependent upon a research grant being awarded and your field being sexy enough to get a research grant and not suddenly to have become uninteresting, so there aren't any research grants in that field. And you're getting more and more and more specialized. And so ultimately the day you could be an absolute, the best of the best of the best in that field, but that field suddenly becomes uninteresting and you've got nowhere to go. So academia is very aggressive in that way. And there are very few senior lecturer posts and even fewer professorial posts. So what do you do with all these people in the middle and the MRC, Wellcome Trust, thousands of organizations? I've been discussing it for as long as I can remember. What do you do about these people in the middle? And at least in our field, those people in the middle now have got a home. They come into biopharma industry. Their mindset is about delivering their research, so translating their research into something that's going to have effect, rather than really pure research, answering a specific question without necessarily worrying about whether it's going to have any patient benefit or any patient application. So it's a different sort of person that we tend to take. And they've got a home, which is brilliant.
So if you were to sum up the challenges that you face as a leader in your two businesses, how would you sum them up?
So in Immune Bio, the challenge is really about it's an organizational challenge. Okay, so we're doing trials all over the world. We've got multiple different companies involved. And you have to motivate, even though you're paying the company. So we're paying a very good contract research organization, clinical research organization called PharmXL. They're great. They're very, very motivated. But you've got to build that relationship and make certain that you're one of their clients, but you want to be their number one client. So you've got to build that relationship and manage that, and then make certain that people who work for me that have to be part of that relationship, have to deliver into that, understand that relationship and where they form in that relationship and why it's important for them to prioritize a response to that company more than that company, because it's about understanding the interrelationships between all of these different players in a clinical trial. So that's really how Immune Bio works, because we are such a small company and we have to rely upon all of these different moving parts. Autonomous, there are four co-founders, each with very different skills. And there we're building our own team. And I have no skills whatsoever in coding or programming. I do know what a program needs to do, but I couldn't tell you how it could do it. So my role there really is explaining to the coders why it's so important for them to get it right and being the client, if you like. So because they're providing something to people like me, my role there is to get them to empathize with me, for them to realize the contribution they're making as coders into medicine, which they've got no knowledge about at all. They're not biologists. And explain to them, as I've tried to explain to you somewhat, the importance of immunity, the importance of cell and gene therapies. They know nothing about that. So a lot of it actually is teaching and trying to inspire them to put in the sort of hours that my team in manufacturing do. And it works. They are really, really dedicated. I'm so impressed by them in terms of the speed they turn things out. Is just remarkable, and the hours they will work. You're used to clinical colleagues being available at 2 o'clock in the morning, but you're not used to programmers being available at 2 o'clock in the morning. And these guys frequently are.
That's exciting. It speaks volumes. Okay, I'm keen to know what drives you, Mark. What kind of gets you out of bed in the morning? What success looks like? All these sorts of things. I've got a question for you. If your business failed commercially tomorrow, but your therapy was proven to be successful and have application, would that be a good day or a bad day for you?
My ethos is I want to change clinical practice. That's what makes me get out of bed in the morning. I want to change, whether it's with my drug or somebody else's drug that we're helping them develop, it has to change clinical practice. And that's the question I ask everybody who comes to me and says, we've got this brilliant idea of doing so and so and so and so. I say, what do you want to do? Do you want to publish a paper in Nature Medicine or do you want to change clinical practice? And the beauty of my post is that I'm funded by the hospital mostly. I only do one day a week for the university. And the university has no oversight of my facility. It's entirely a hospital. So if I don't want to support bizarre academic study, you want to, I can just say, I'm too busy. And I have that luxury. And so we only do things that we think can change clinical practice.
You've been chasing this goal for 25 years. So what makes it so exciting and so challenging that keeps you running at the speed at which you are clearly still running?
So I'm extremely lucky. You know, I'm not one of those academics that's done the, I'm going to become the expert, the expert, the expert. I am passionate about my invention, my discovery, my field. But if I just focused on that, then the risk would be enormous. I still haven't proven it works. I may never prove it works. And it would be, a waste of a career. What keeps me running, it's being able to facilitate other people's work as much as it is developing my own. It's all about changing clinical practice, and that's what's exciting, whether it be my therapy or anybody else's.
Is there a bigger goal that sits behind this, Mark? For example, if Immune Bio is a huge commercial success because your therapies are proven to help people, and they do, and you have that, you know, that huge goal achieved, what happens? Do you get up and go to work the next day and chase the next goal? Is there a next goal, or are you going to give yourself a bit of time?
So I think I said earlier on that the selfish gene was what made this all start. And Richard Dawkins, I had the luck of sheer amazing luck of bumping into Richard Dawkins at Heathrow some years ago. And we sat down and I told him the story, and he said, gosh, I never even realized that the immune system was a model of evolution. And that made me so proud that I could tell Richard Dawkins something he didn't know. But I would love to write the selfish gene of immunology. And I've got sketches of it on my laptop. When I'm on planes, I quite often add an extra few lines to it or whatever. But I would like to write that book, because I think the lay public needs to understand how important the immune system is, how powerful it is, and get rid of some of the quackery. There's a lot of quackery around immunology, immunotherapy, and try and remove some of that quackery. So yeah, that's a real retirement ambition.
Mark, what advice would you give your younger self, knowing what you know now? What would you say to yourself if you could go back and give yourself some good advice?
Be better at building consensus. The two biggest failures that I've had have been because I haven't realized that other people have hidden agendas and are more Machiavellian and will actually work behind the scenes to stop me doing something that I see as perfectly logical, and therefore, since it's perfectly logical, everybody must buy into it because it's so logical. And of course, you know, not everybody is driven by the most straight line, the most logical thing. And consensus building. Be smarter about it. Spend more time not working. Spend more time communicating and pressing the flesh, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay, Mark, so a few quick questions for you. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
Book or Audible?
Book.
Apple or Android?
Android.
And gig, concert or theatre?
Theatre.
When you're not working, what's the most enjoyable way you can spend your leisure time?
Sailing on my own boat in Scotland. We've got to bring it back next year, so I'll be doing around Britain in it. And it's a comfortable boat. It's mine or it's ours. I know where everything is. You know, it's that sort of, it's like being at home, but at sea. So that's where I'd be.
Wonderful.
Well, when you learn to sail as a kid, it's the first time that you're actually in charge of something that you have to have full control over. And so it's very empowering, sort of, you know, when kids go off on their first sail on their own in a dinghy. I remember it, you know, acutely. And then you're training other kids to sail. And it's a fantastic way of empowering kids and giving them leadership skills.
Brilliant, Mark. That's absolutely fantastic. What a way to end the episode. We've run out of time. Thank you so, so much for joining us and being a guest on Coffee First.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Coffee First. Please don't forget to hit the subscribe button, follow our Twitter account, CoffeeFirst13, and follow the Amrop UK LinkedIn page for all company updates. We look forward to inviting you back for the next episode of Coffee First.